You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, November 28th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, founder of 350.org, distinguished scholar at Middlebury College, Bill McKibben, on his Do the Math tour. Also on the program today, an Idaho lawmaker may have cracked the code. Mitt Romney could still be president. Meanwhile, the grand bargain watch continues. Democrats pulling Social Security off the table and Medicare-ish off the table. Or Medicare offish the table. Three words. Mom, mom, mom. Longtime listeners of this program will know what that story is about. Good news for Two and a Half Men. What's his name? Angus T. John? Jones. That said, well, maybe Two and a Half Men's not so bad. I don't know. I'm trying to get some positive stories in here today, folks. Update a hearing on the Bradley Manning case today. And, of course, Benghazi, Benghazi, Benghazi. But I want to start with this. Before we go to Bill McKibben. Earlier this week. I don't even know. No, it was last week. We had, what was his name now? Jeff Orlowski, who was the director-producer of a film called Chasing Ice, which I keep recommending to you. If you're in D.C. or you're on the West Coast, you can. We have a link on the blog to the site, Chasing Ice, to find out when it's playing. And, you know, just to offer some shred of optimism on the global warming front, this is a video that I just saw of a woman who had just seen Chasing Ice. I don't know if she saw it in New York or in D.C. She must have seen it just in the past couple of days. This is a video apparently shot a testimonial from this woman when she came out of the theater, and it is extremely encouraging. Like I say, you can listen to the whole Jeff Orlowski interview from last week on the show. If you have a chance, go see the movie. But the movie, it's a beautiful movie, and it's obviously extremely powerful. But listen to what this woman had to say. It is reason for optimism.
Let me say what I have to say, that I watch Bill O'Reilly every day. I love Bill O'Reilly. I'm proud to be an American. But I saw this movie, Chasing Ice, today, and it hasn't just changed me about global warming. It has changed me as a person. And there is something, I don't know what I can do. I'm 60 years old, but there must be something I can do to help this, to help our children, to help my grandkids. But I'm going to change it, because this movie was fantastic. Every human being in this world should watch this movie. Everyone.
And you didn't believe in global warming?
I did not believe in global warming. I'm going to be 60 on December 21. And every time someone mentioned global warming to me, I told them if they wanted to remain in my home, they needed to step out. Because I said it was bullshit. I didn't believe it. Excuse my language. And That is because I listen, and this is the truth, I believe Bill Riley.
And now you saw this movie.
And I saw this movie, and I apologize to anyone I ever talked into not into believing there was no global warming. I have talked every friend, every person I know into believing there is no global warming. And now I have to undo my damage. And I will. But the moment I go to my car, go home, go to my computer, it has changed my life.
Wow, that's great. That's
thank
really
you.
Cool.
Thank you for giving me this moment. It was a great movie.
Okay, thank you.
Wow, powerful stuff. So that's encouraging. And again, if you have the opportunity to see this film, go do it by all means. All right, we've got to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Bill McKibben. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program distinguished scholar at Middlebury College and one of the founders of 350.org. He is on the Do the Math tour right now, Bill McKibben. Bill, thanks so much for joining us.
It's fun to be with you, man.
So now, Bill, you had mentioned to us when we caught up with you, I guess it was over the summer, maybe it was at Netroots Nation, that following the election, you would be rolling out a new initiative, and I guess it was Do the Math. And so tell us about this. Tell us about this tour.
Well, so we've been on the road every night since election. The night after the election, we started in Seattle. We've now made it down the West Coast and down the East Coast, and now we're heading across the country. We're in Chicago today. We've done, except for a couple of nights at Thanksgiving, big shows every night, and they've all been sold out at 2,000 and 3,000 seat venues. So it's a different kind of thing than the environmental movement's done in the past, but we're finding it to be a great organizing tool. It's all about taking on the fossil fuel industry directly, and one of the tools we're using is divestment, and there's about 140 now college campuses that have kicked off divestment campaigns in the last few weeks as we've done this tour. So it's really, you know, the roadshow itself is exciting and lots of fun, but the key part is that it's translating into organizing and fast.
So tell us about what does the divestment involve?
We're trying to get colleges, universities, churches, pension funds to sell their stock in the big fossil fuel companies. The theory is that, you know, the math that I laid out for all of this in Rolling Stone in the summer, and it's the basis of this tour, simply demonstrates how irresponsible these guys have become. They're a kind of rogue force. They've got five times more carbon in their declared reserves than even the most conservative government thinks would be safe to burn. So, you know, what the tobacco industry was to individual human beings, the fossil fuel industry is to planets, of which we only have, you know, one that we can inhabit. That's what we're getting at. And in fact, we actually had way ahead of schedule the first college that announced it was divesting all its funds from fossil fuels just a few days ago. Unity College in Maine, their board of trustees voted. A few days later, the student body at Harvard voted 3-1 to demand that the Harvard trustees do the same thing. So the fight is on.
That's fantastic. And how does this represent a shift in the thinking about how to organize and get active in terms of global warming? Because it seems to explain it to me.
We're going much more after the fossil fuel industry than we have in the past. That's the thing. We're hard at work trying to get the industry sort of tarnished. Not so much worrying about their bought and paid for politicians at the moment, although we're continuing to work hard on things like the Keystone Pipeline. But the real task right now, Sam, is just to try and change the basic dynamic here. We think that the fossil fuel industry and their wealth and the political power that it translates into is the reason we've had so little luck for so long in getting anything done in Washington and a lot of other capitals.
Yeah, I mean, I think Chris Hayes, and maybe it was the weekend that you were on, but I'm not sure exactly when he said it, but he described it that climate change is an issue that we haven't seen since really slavery as an institution, at least in the context of this country, where there was so much financial resources and so much financial interest at stake in changing our perspective on this.
Yes, I mean, it's obviously not a perfect analogy since slavery is a much, you know, more abhorrent moral thing. But there's also the kind of parallel that you know, people are saying there's no possible way we could run our economic system without, you know. And in fact, we're finding out that that's not true. The good news from this very bad year, a year that's seen record flood and heat and drought and everything else, the good news is coming from Germany, the one big country that's taken seriously any of this stuff. And they're just beginning to show, more than beginning, astonishing results from their renewables program. There were days this summer when Germany produced more than half the power it used from solar panels within its borders. That's a sign that, I mean, given where Germany is located on the map, that's a sign that what we need is not sunlight, it's political will. And hopefully we can start to supply some of that. But it means getting past the political power of the fossil fuel industry first.
I was going to ask you about that because we actually had OSHA Gray Davidson on the program.
Was that
the
a terrific
day.
Book? His Kindle there or whatever it is. It's really something.
Yes, and it's encouraging because in some respects, it seems to be the first I don't know how to really describe it, but it seems to be the first sort of optimistic argument in terms of our capacity to deal with this problem. And, you know, my question to him and my question to you, too, is, you know, what have you seen in terms of across this country? Because it seems to me that localizing the generation of our power through these sort of distributed system is something that can sort of happen in parallel to as we have the existence of this sort of fossil fuel centralized based system.
I think that in one sense that's true. The problem is that as long as fossil fuel doesn't pay anything for the damage that carbon does in the atmosphere, you're always going to have this tremendous cost advantage to using dirty energy instead of clean. So it's why it's a two-pronged fight. We got to be doing locally, you know, this is, you know, most of my writing and stuff for years now has been about the need for local economies, local energy, all of that. We have to be doing that, but at the same time, we have to be working globally and nationally to change the ground rules so that this can happen, not just happen, so that it can happen fast enough to really matter. That's the problem. We're up against the clock now.
And do you think that there's any way for us to overcome the climate crisis and continue sort of our lifestyle, keep driving everywhere?
Well, I don't think in exactly. Yeah, I mean, some of the stuff we can keep doing. There are things that we can't. I don't see any way that allows the kind of endless continued growth of jet aircraft travel around the world, for instance. But that's okay because in, you know, the last 10 years, we've learned to do an awful lot of our traveling by mouse, you know. Suddenly the internet is doing some of what Pan Am used to, you know. And we're going to have to do more of that. So we can't have, you can't just take the American, huge American machine, toss out the internal combustion engine, stick in a windmill, and carry on precisely as before. But, you know,
the world that we're building will in many ways be sweeter than the one we're inhabiting now, and far more democratic once its, you know, energy sources come from close to home.
One of the other things I want to talk to you about was the we also had the opportunity to talk to Jeff Orlowski, whose film Chasing Ice is now playing across the country, and I just
we're showing little snippets of it every night on this roadshow, trying to get people to go to it. It's an amazing film, and people got to go see it if they it comes to near them.
And we just played actually just a short video, I guess, that was shot of a woman coming out of the movie, basically. Talking.
I saw that. She said, "I've listened to Bill O'Reilly every day, and now I'm believing global warming." And yeah, that was powerful testimony.
Talk to us about what the concept of feedback loop is, because I'm now seeing, you know, the UN, I guess it is now talking about, you know, monitoring the permafrost, which apparently is not so perma anymore.
A study yesterday showing permafrost melting at a faster rate than we had thought. Not good news at all. Another big study today showing sea level rising about 60% faster than we had thought. Also not good news. Look, once you heat the planet to a certain point, things begin to start happening of their own accord, and we're clearly getting near those points. Which is why it's so imperative that we, you know, stop talking about what we're going to do in 2050 and start taking serious action right now.
Now, is that the feedback loop? I mean, when you start to when the processes, the damage that we're doing to the environment start to feed in and create even more damage?
Exactly right. When, you know, we have our hand on the thermostat for the moment, but if we raise the temperature high enough that, say, permafrost is melting in large quantities and methane is being released into the atmosphere, we don't have any way of dialing that down. We can dial down the CO2 by, you know, changing our cars and factories and things, but we don't have any way of refreezing the permafrost.
And I also want to talk to you about one of the things. There was a story out today, I guess it was today in Slate, talking about, you know, that to a certain extent, under the Obama administration, between the stimulus, the American Recovery Act, and other initiatives, that there seems to be a little bit more attention being paid to efficiency. But when you view that in the context of the greater argument about energy independence, why do we see the sort of the argument of energy independence being sort of discussed almost as if it's a separate context from climate change? You know, as
well, no, it's always discussed that way, as if the real, I mean, it's this thing we've fallen into now, and I think sometimes the Obama administration's really fallen into it, of solving the kind of lingering problems of the 20th century instead of focusing on the emergent problems of the 21st, you know? I mean, this energy independence thing is something that people have talked about for 50 years, how sad it is that we import oil from places or whatever. Well, that may have been the worst problem we had with oil 25 years ago, but it doesn't even come close to the problem that climate change presents now. So it would be much better to start talking about independence from fossil fuel, you know, which we're clearly, if Germany can do it, I mean, Germany lacks Arizona, New Mexico, California, Nevada, Florida, Texas, you know, Munich's north of Montreal. So I don't know what we're monkeying around with.
And we're on the eve of the Doha climate change talks. Give me a sense of, are there other countries? I mean, obviously, Germany is one which is addressing this in an incredibly aggressive fashion. Are there other countries out there that are leading this charge? I mean, what are the dynamics, at least in terms of on an international level? Who are the players that we should be looking to that are pushing this, and who are the ones that are dragging their feet?
Well, it's a pretty short list. I mean, it's really short if you say what are the non-Scandinavian countries that are engaged in this. Look, nobody's covering themselves with glory. Everybody's waiting for the U.S. and China to act. U.S. and China keep saying, "I'll wait for you. You know, you first. No, you first. After you." It's just turned into a sort of macabre dance. And, you know, I didn't even bother going to this Doha thing this year at all. You know, just a charade at this point, until we break the power of the fossil fuel industry enough to open up some real possibilities.
And what is that? I mean, what does that look like? I mean, breaking the power of the fossil fuel industry, is it
you know, there was a time not that long ago when Philip Morris was a perfectly respectable company, you know, the way that Exxon is today. We got to get to the point where they're the biggest financial players in our elections and things, where that comes with a cost as well as a benefit to people.
Is there any attempt to attack, I guess, this industry in the same way that the tobacco industry was attacked, in terms of some type of civil actions,
actions? Clearly this would be the mother of all torts, you know,
right.
But it's almost, I mean, the problem almost is that it's so big that it's like, it's hard to find a court. It's sort of unclear what court you go to when your country has just disappeared beneath the waves, you know. There are people doing good work along these ways, and we're sort of waiting for some breakthroughs, hopefully. But I got to tell you, right now, our court system is not really in the hands of people inclined to listen very carefully to these arguments.
And let me ask you this, and this is also a question from the audience, but I mean, it's one that I've asked you before, but how do you, both personally and I think, you know, as one of the nation's sort of leading activists on this front, continue to stay positive? Because, I mean,
it's just, you know, that there's a lot of people willing to fight. That's the thing. I mean, we've been getting reception to this. If people go to mathsbat350.org, I actually don't think there's any tickets left any place for the upcoming shows, but they can at least get a sense of where it is that, you know, just watch this kind of spreading excitement. We'll have a video, a kind of concert video of all of this that our friend Josh Fox is putting together, and it'll be out by January as a kind of organizing tool. So people will be able to see it, and they'll see the kind of energy that there is all over the country for taking action on a scale commensurate with the problem. That's the thing.
And so what is the what follows this? I mean, I assume that you guys have sort of gamed this out in some fashion.
Yeah. So there's a lot of things. I mean, you know, gamed it out to some degree. There are a lot of things. We'll be running these big divestment campaigns as many places as we can, helping people all we can to make them work. And then there'll be sort of shareholder meeting, you know, civil disobedience, that kind of stuff going on, hopefully building up into a kind of summer of action. But we also, of course, have to very quickly take this worldwide. So 350.org works in 191 countries. Since we think the UN process is broken, we're convening a global power shift, the summit of six or seven young people from every country on earth in Istanbul in June, to kind of try and shame them into doing what they should be doing all along.
Are there, are there particular countries that might be where it is easier to attack the fossil fuel industries? In other words, they have less.
There's some interesting possibilities. You know, Norway is a very interesting country, very progressive, but also a big state-owned oil industry. You know, so we'll see how it goes.
Interesting, because I would imagine the getting at the place where the sort of the power is, you know, less concentrated. This country, it seems, has been dominated by oil interests for 75 years in some respects.
We're the most addicted country on earth, so it's no wonder it's the hardest nut to crack. But there's a lot of hard nuts to crack, and frankly, I'm sort of probably rather be working here than trying to do the same thing in Russia right now.
Right. Indeed. All right. Well, Bill, I really appreciate it. I know you're obviously literally running on tour, and
I've got to take off here. I'm such a pleasure to talk to you, Sam.
Thank you, guys, Bill.
As always, for your good work.
Thanks for talking to us.
Take care, man.
All right, folks. That's Bill McKibben, and like he said, the tour is sold out. So I guess you'll be waiting for the for the concert for the concert video. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we will. I've got a couple of stories for you. We'll talk about what's going on with the grand bargain. You're never going to guess. This is going to come as a complete shock to you. But here's a little quiz as we take the take a break. Which two old coots who are in the news, who are going around talking about how you're all teat suckers for wanting to have a pension in your retirement years? Which two old coots who hate the idea that you might have, $1,200 a month to spend in your retirement are making upwards around 40 grand per speaking engagement as they go around advocating that you get no pension when you're older? We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I will give you the answer, and we'll give you a grand bargain update. Oh, is that a hint? We are back, Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. Our daily, I don't mean to do it daily, but it turns out to be more or less daily, our grand bargain update. Or you want to call it the austerity bomb update, the fiscal cliff update, whatever. Everybody's got their own branding mechanism for this. So yesterday I mentioned that Dick Durbin, and the reason why Dick Durbin is such an important figure in this mix is because there's very good reason to believe that Dick Durbin is essentially President Obama's voice in the Senate. And we saw Dick Durbin sign on to parts of Simpson Bowles, I think it was, at the time, which was an 18-person commission attempting to ratify recommendations. They needed 14 votes. They didn't get them. I don't know if Durbin voted for it or not. Off the top of my head, I seem to think he did. But regardless, he was talking about so-called entitlement or social insurance reform. And by reform, of course, what we mean is cuts. Back during the last round of debt ceiling negotiations of whatever it was. And he is now singing, or at least talking, a different tune. Social Security, he is saying, should be off the table. And apparently updated later yesterday, Durbin met with Senate Democrats. He clarified his positions on Social Security and on Medicare and Medicaid. And supposedly what he said is, what I'm saying is, what I'm talking about now is the immediate. What takes us to the end of the year to avoid the fiscal cliff, he said, adding that Medicare and Medicaid should not be part of those talks. But, he said, when you're talking about long-term deficit reduction, $4 trillion worth, entitlement reform needs to be a part of it. So at the very least, he's punting on Medicare and Medicaid. Social Security, too? No. Social Security, you take off the table and put in a separate commission. Now, that's good news, because there's nothing more sure to end in nothing happening than when you put something into a separate commission. Blue ribbon commission is Washington speak more often than not for do nothing commission. You also had Chris Van Hollen, who is a deputy to Nancy Pelosi in the House, on MSNBC yesterday, saying that with respect to Social Security, I agree with what the president has said and what Peter DeFazio has said. Social Security is not part of the deficit and debt problem. This is really good stuff to hear. So now we're back to what Ronald Reagan said in whatever it was, 1986, where he said it's not part of the deficit. Maybe it was 84 or 80. I can't remember when he was running and said this. And so we are now back into sanity, into sort of, at least when we talk about Social Security, into the world of normalness and sanityhood. I'm just coining words left and right today. We're not going to raid Social Security in order to balance other parts of the budget. Good. There's plenty of time between now and 2033 that if we decide we want to pay out 100% of benefits due retirees rather than 78% of benefits, we simply raise the cap, get rid of the cap, create a donut hole. It doesn't matter. Either one provides solvency way, way into the future. I mean, I'm talking 75-year horizon to the point where, you know, at that point, half of New York will be permanently underwater. And we will take how much income Social Security is, the tax is, or income is subject to Social Security tax from where it's traditionally been, 90%, to where it is now, to 81%, back up to 90%. That's the way the system was designed. Right now, we are not functioning, the system is not functioning as it was designed because of income disparity, for no other reason, income disparity. They already did the rejiggering. They already knew there was going to be baby boomers. They already knew what the ratio of workers to retirees was. All that was known and knowable 25 years ago. 25 years ago? Plus, when the maestro, Greenspan, was tapped to head a commission by Reagan to deal with this in the future. When they raised the Social Security tax. Yes, Reagan raised taxes. Van Hollen also rejected cutting Medicare benefits. So what we're seeing at least is, and, you know, take it with a grain of salt. We cannot stop pushing on this front. We're seeing Democrats talk about different fixes from Medicare, which don't necessarily affect benefits. I can tell you one big one right off the top, $250 billion a year in you want to reform something, reform the patents that drug companies get, the rent seeking that these pharmaceutical companies are getting by decree of the government that they keep prices artificially inflated for drugs. You want to close, you want to allow Medicare to negotiate in volume with drug companies to create savings. There's a whole raft of reforms that need to take place that not only have the benefit of cutting Medicare expenditures, but also have the benefit of driving prices down even in the private sector on the cost of medical care. And understand, you know, you hear Democrats talk about we're not going to allow for Social Security privatization. We're not going to allow for privatization of Medicare. When you talk about raising the retirement age, or when you talk about raising the eligibility age for Medicare, That is privatization. Because those seniors are not going to say, like, okay, I don't get my Medicare as opposed to 65. I don't get it until 67. I'm going to do without medical insurance for those 2 years. No, they go and buy it on a private market. Now, after 2014, they'll be able to do that. But it will increase the prices that everybody pays because they're going to affect the risk pool. So it's just another way of saying privatization. If you raise the retirement age in which people are eligible for Social Security, you're privatizing people's retirement if they want to retire at 65 or 67 for someone like me. That's just another way to say privatization. And in terms of the any type of deal for raising taxes, you're now starting to see just slight cracks in the Republicans' caucus in the House. Most of the talk about people leaving Grover Norquist behind has been hyped and inflated. Just about everybody cited was already at that position 2 years ago. But the former head of the National Republican Campaign Committee, Tom Cole, a member of the House Republican caucus, according to David Dayen, expressed support for Republicans cutting their losses on taxes by passing an extension of the Bush tax cuts on the first $250,000 of income and letting them expire above. Now, this is all out of he's an Oklahoma Republican. I guess he gave an interview with Politico. He believes that such a vote would not violate Grover Norquist's anti-tax pledge. I mean, who knows? These guys are doing, you know, it's so pathetic to see them sort of wrap themselves in pretzels. But here's the game plan for the Republicans. If you vote affirmatively before January 1, when all of the Bush tax cuts expire, what you can finagle here, or at least what they're hoping to finagle, is, okay, we're going to allow taxes on every dollar made above $250,000 to be subject to an extra 3% income tax, more or less. But what we will salvage, because people forget this, that when we talk about the Bush tax cuts expiring, going back to Clinton rates, we're also talking about capital gains taxes raising at least 5%. We're also talking about the estate tax going back to Clinton era levels. And so what the Republicans want to do is make it seem like they're allowing taxes on the every dollar made after 250 grand to go up. But they're going to keep those capital gains cuts. And at the end of the day, most rich people get most of their income from capital gains anyways. And so, in addition to the amount of revenue being much less coming in, it's a much less of a bite. So that's why you should not react with like, oh my God, these Republicans have seen the light. They realize they look like big douchebags for protecting the tax cuts of the rich. They're still protecting the tax cuts of the rich. They're just, you know, making it, they're dressing the windows a little bit more. So keep that in mind. And finally, as promised, before that little brief hiatus we just took, one which I don't even think you could squeeze in an ad. However, we can squeeze in ads. People are interested. New York Times reports, it's such a bubbly piece in the New York Times. It's sort of grotesque, but apparently, according to the New York Times, Erskine Bowles and Alan Simpson, those two old coots who wrote that letter to President Obama saying, get those teat suckers off the teat. Stop letting people have some type of dignity in their retirement, unless their daddy was like mine in Simpson's case and gave me a lot of money, unless I worked for Morgan Stanley in Erskine Bowles' case. We're fine. But all those other teat suckers, let them eat cat food. Well, apparently, and this is the sad part of the story, Simpson and Bowles, during the late stages of 2010, and I really should play some sad music for this. Simpson and Bowles, during the late stages of 2010, when they were crafting their Cat Food Commission report, had to fly weekly to Washington without compensation. Mr. Simpson said he had spent about $25,000 of his own money. Not so much to fly to Washington, but to upgrade from government-rate coach seating to premium class. Dude had to go first class, man. I had to pay for that out of my own pocket. Life is tough for a millionaire. I would just go to Washington, do my work, and it's not like I met with any type of lobbyists or did some business for the board of directors that I sat on or any of that stuff. And then they were contacted by the Washington Speaker's Bureau and offered somewhere between $32,000 each to go on a speaking tour. Mr. Simpson said, at first we weren't sure if we wanted to do it. And then we said, yes, okay, we'll do it. Then the money rose to $36,000 and landed at $40,000. Now, often they do appear without a fee, but that only serves to drive their prices of their speaking going up. So, to you two old coots, Simpson and Bowles, appreciate the fact that on one hand you can say to Grandma, F you, Grandma, and on the other hand, ka-ching, ka-ching, we get paid 40 G large each almost every time we say that in front of an audience of rich people. You know what that's called? America, bitches! America! All right. We're going to take a break, head into the better half of the program. It's 646-257-3920 is the number. The IM machine is already in full effect. We've got IM stacked up. Coming up in the second half, the better half of the program. Yes, the superior half of the program. Idaho lawmaker cracked the code. Mitt Romney can still be president. More on that when we return. Also, just a little bit of a taste of where this next story is going.
Mom! 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 Why did you do that to me?
Longtime listeners will know what that's all about. And, yeah, we'll do an update on the that guy from Two and a Half Men. In part of my... I was determined to have some... happy stories. Oh, I do have one other really sweet story in the second half of the program. So, you know, there's always that danger when you're talking about climate change that people just get too despondent. And I don't know. I feel like between that story of what Germany has been doing, between that story of how powerful that chasing ice is, and that Bill McKibben, always an optimistic voice. I actually think, you know, I'm feeling more optimistic about our ability to do something on climate change than I have in the past. But I still have another nice, sweet story in the better half, and we'll give you an update on what's going on with this Manning hearing today. All that and more. 646-257-3920. We'll be right back after this.
Say to Apple Pay.